Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
I'm Robin Ince.
Welcome to the 27th season of The Infinite Monkey Cage.
And we are dealing with some very, very explosive things, such as
bees.
We're going to explain how bees explode, why wasps don't explode, how delicious wasp honey is, before we then climb into a supervolcano, metaphorically.
And then we're going to discover how you might feed yourself inside the supervolcano by eating fungi.
Or ultra-processed food. We're also going to look at ancient DNA and
sharks.
Listen to The Infinite Monkey Cage wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 9th of June, these are our main stories. More evidence is emerging that the Kakhovka Dam in Ukraine was deliberately blown up. Donald Trump has been formally charged over his handling of classified documents after he left the White House. EU ministers have approved a radical overhaul of how the bloc deals with the growing number of migrants seeking asylum in Europe. Also in this podcast, new research suggests that there are far more people in India with diabetes than previously thought, and the number is expected to grow. And
welcome to Paris, Joseph.
Monsieur, I fear this will not be a kind place to such a boy.
Brought to the big screen, the story of the young son of a Caribbean slave turned composer in 18th century Paris. We speak to the director. First to Ukraine, where more evidence is emerging that the Kakhovka Dam in Ukraine was deliberately blown up. The details from Norway, Romania and Ukraine itself, including a recording which suggests that Russia was involved. Initial reports of the dam's collapse were issued in the early hours of Tuesday morning. I spoke to Paul Adams, our correspondent in Kyiv.
So there are two things that have emerged today. One is that the Norwegian scientists at an organisation called NORSAR, who have a network of seismic stations, monitored at 2:54 a.m. on Tuesday morning via a station in Romania around 600 kilometres from Nova Kakhovka, a significant seismic event thought to have been created by a huge, huge explosion. Anything less wouldn't really have transmitted in this way. So that indicates to them that within a radius of about 20 to 30 kilometres of Nova Kakhovka, some huge seismic event took place. Then you have the Ukrainian Domestic Intelligence Service, the SBU, releasing a recording of what they say, and we cannot verify this, but what they say is a recording of two Russian soldiers speaking about the destruction of the dam, saying that it was indeed conducted by a Russian sabotage group, but saying that actually the explosion went further than planned, that it was designed to scare the Ukrainians, but not necessarily to bring the dam down. So two bits of circumstantial evidence. Nothing is proved as a result of this. But I think together they do lend weight to the notion, which I think, frankly, most independent experts have already reached themselves, which is that Russia was responsible for this because the location of the explosion has already been identified as having been towards the southern end of the dam, where the dam and the adjacent hydroelectric plant meet. And that was under Russian control and has been since last year.
And very briefly, Paul, obviously this has put news of the military aspect of all this onto the back burner at the moment. But it is carrying on, isn't it, particularly in Zaporizhia?
It is. I should just say one last thing about this, which is that there is a problem with the timeline, because there are eyewitness reports and indeed some CCTV from Tuesday morning, which suggests that a breach in the dam had already occurred before this seismic event was monitored. So we are still investigating this. We are still trying to get to the bottom of it. But in the meantime, you're right. There is plenty of evidence that Ukraine's long-anticipated counteroffensive is ramping up, particularly in the area south and east of the city of Zaporizhia, very much the area where most people expected to see the Ukrainians trying to probe Russia's fortifications, trying to find some way of breaking through with the possible objective of trying to cut through to the Sea of Azov and cutting the Russian-controlled territory in two. It's all in its very early days at the moment, but it is ramping up.
That was Paul Adams. Now, there is one big story making the rounds in the United States.
Now, earlier this evening, the news came from the defendant himself. Donald Trump told his millions of followers on Truth Social that he was going to be indicted.
A sealed indictment has charged the former president of the United States in what is reportedly a 7-count indictment.
Our breaking news tonight, the federal indictment of Donald Trump. The first time in American history that a former president has faced federal charges.
Yes, Mr. Trump, as you heard there, has been charged over his handling of classified documents after he left the White House. In a statement on social media, he said he'd done nothing wrong. Well, the former federal prosecutor, Joe Moreno, says he's not surprised by the indictments.
Donald Trump, through his lawyers, issued basically a sworn statement saying, I've given you everything. And the fact is he hadn't given over everything, and he had over 100 more in his possession. I mean, that's the case. I mean, call it obstruction of a grand jury, call it perjury, but that's effectively what it is, that you know, the allegation will be that he lied.
Well, it comes after thousands of documents were seized from Mr. Trump's home last year, some of them marked as classified. Robert Ray was one of his attorneys during his 2020 impeachment. He says that as a former president, Donald Trump will have additional defenses.
The president has defenses, but they include not just the usual ones that defendants make, but also the fact as a president and former president, he had certain powers with regard to classified information that no other person in America has. And those are going to be things that the Justice Department is going to have to overcome in order to prove that he illegally withheld classified information.
So how will Mr. Trump's indictment affect his election run for the White House? Here's our North America special correspondent, Katty Kay.
We have a long campaign ahead of us, another 17 months of this election campaign. There could be yet more indictments that come the president's way. And I think it would be foolish to say now that we know how this is going to turn out politically. We can look at what's happened in the past. And what's happened in the past is that whenever Donald Trump has faced legal problems or other incidents like this, it hasn't really affected his popularity with the base of Americans who support him. The last indictment back in April barely moved the needle one way or the other in terms of his poll numbers in comparison to Joe Biden, for example. So I don't think we know yet. It is possible that the cumulative nature of the scandals and the legal problems facing Donald Trump could eventually chip away at some of those people who might have voted for him. You can think of people always talk about, you know, the apocryphal suburban woman in the suburbs of, you know, Philadelphia or Atlanta or Milwaukee or Phoenix, those key cities and key states that are going to be in play next year. And how will they feel if there are multiple indictments against the former president? But I do think we should also point out that at the moment, the president thinks this is going to work in his favor. The Truth Social posts that he has put out come with a little button which allows you to donate to his political campaign. And he used the previous indictment to raise money. So he'll try and do that again. And he and his supporters believe that this is a witch hunt against him. And I think you're going to see, you know, that they'll rally some support. The question is, will it affect any of the very few people in America who are left that haven't made up their mind about which way they're going to vote? Possibly it could swing them to the former president's side.
That was Caddy Kay. Nearly 300 orphans caught in the crossfire of the ongoing conflict in Sudan have been evacuated from the capital, Khartoum. The International Committee of the Red Cross said that they'd been taken to the city of Wad Madani, 200 kilometres to the south. Jean-Christophe Sandoz is the organisation's head of delegation to Sudan.
It was really heartbreaking to see all these children, some of them having mental health conditions, some other health conditions, to be there in the midst really of conflict. So during the operation there was some activities which we heard also, and these children have been there for the past 6 weeks.
where nearly 70 children at the Maigoma orphanage have died from malnutrition, dehydration and infection since the fighting broke out between the rival military factions in April. Fashions come and go, but until now, airline staff have had to remain traditional and conservative in how they appear and what they wear. But now, the Australian airline Qantas has relaxed its gender-based uniform rules. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, is following the story. I asked him what's acceptable now.
Well, there's a whole series of rule changes that Qantas introduced, and essentially what they've done is getting rid of the boundaries between men's uniforms and women's uniforms. So, for example, now men can wear long hair as long as they tie it up. They can wear makeup. Women no longer have to wear high heels. Both sexes can wear jewellery if they want to do, and watch sizes, a strange one this, but previously Qantas said that women would have to wear small watches with smaller faces than men. Now that seems a silly requirement, but that's gone as well. So a whole series of changes which Qantas is bringing in order really, as I said, to reduce the difference between men's and women's uniforms.
Yeah, just outlining that those rules up until now, they do seem very archaic, don't they? So why particularly has Qantas decided now to make the change?
Well, for a number of reasons. Firstly, there's been a lot of pressure from the unions in Australia to change this. That they essentially were saying that the uniforms just didn't reflect the way people wanted to dress. And Qantas acknowledged that. They said that, OK, these uniforms or these rules are now going to allow people to be more comfortable, they're more practical, and they recognise that fashions change. Also, a number of other airlines, Bonza, a budget airline in Australia, they have already changed their uniforms of their cabin crew, and they've gone even further. Things like trainers and shorts are now allowed. So there's a trend towards that. And of course, the idea of gender identity is now a more fluid concept. And so essentially what they're doing is just reflecting a change in the times.
Yeah, and I imagine people aren't going to object. If you're in first class, you might not want people to wear shorts and flip-flops, but people aren't going to object to any of this, are they, I would have thought?
Probably not, and probably other airlines will follow suit, but some will still hold out. It still is an industry where cabin crew often are dressed very formally and have very strict and conservative codes. I just had a look before we came on air at Etihad Airways, and they even dictate things such as the shade of lipstick that their female cabin crew have to wear. So I think there's going to be some time yet we're going to see still strict guidelines for people flying in the air.
That was our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow. Scientists and emergency officials say that the wildfires and air pollution affecting large swathes of Canada and the United States will become more regular in future because of global warming. Well, millions of people have been urged to wear face masks as some eastern cities have temporarily become the most polluted cities on Earth. President Joe Biden said it was a stark reminder of climate change. Well, the head of Canada's Forest Fire Centre, Kim Connors, told the BBC that there needed to be more focus on coping with fires.
As communities and citizens, we have to find ways to be resilient to this climate change and to live with fire, because what we're doing now in Canada and in other parts of the world at different times of the year, Chile a few months ago, it's not sustainable. So firefighters just will not be able to keep going. We need a different tactic globally on how we make resilient communities through landscape fire management and mitigation.
Still to come.
Pasarokam.
This is reminiscent of Stalin's time, Oleg Orlov tells me. Civil society has been pushed underground, partially. I fear it may now be completely destroyed.
Another Kremlin critic goes on trial after addressing the war in Ukraine. Our Russia editor assesses the mood.
The explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The spiritual head of the Anglican Church has urged the clergy in Uganda to reject a new anti-gay law that has just been approved by President Yoweri Museveni. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, said that there was no justification for Anglicans to support the legislation that went against Christian teaching. Wazir Kamsin reports.
Justin Welby has written to Stephen Kazimba, the head of the church in Uganda, expressing his grief and dismay that the church has thrown its weight behind the controversial law. In a statement, the Archbishop said he was aware of the history of colonial rule in the country, but insisted that this wasn't about imposing Western values. The Anglican Church, which has many followers in Africa, is deeply divided over attitudes towards same-sex relationships. Under Uganda's new law, gay sex is now punishable by life in prison.
For many years, India has been called the diabetes capital of the world. Now, a new report says the number of people with the disease across the country is likely to exceed 100 million. That's according to a new study published in the Lancet Diabetes Journal. One of the authors is Dr. Ranjit Anjana. She's a consultant at Dr. Mohan's diabetes practice in Chennai, and she's told me about some of the reasons for this big increase.
Overall, there is an increase in starchy, sweet, salty, high-calorie foods. And that has definitely increased over the last few years.
And that's in all parts of India. This has been parts of India, rural communities and urban communities.
More so in urban, but it's also trickling down to rural communities as well, because the availability of these things is all over the place. And about 60 to 70% of everything the Asian Indian eats is carbohydrate.
So what can be done to address the problem?
So the new figures does talk about an increase in the prevalence of diabetes from previous reported figures, not just for diabetes, but also for pre-diabetes. So actually, this gives us a huge window of opportunity for prevention. Now, what has the government already started doing? There is this Ayushman Bharat scheme in which 150 wellness centers have been started in various cities across the country with the notion of trying to target high-risk people, those with obesity, those with pre-diabetes, and try to make lifestyle changes, simple things, diet, physical activity, stress reduction. So I think the whole point is to look at trying to bring down prevalence by intervening in sections of society that are high risk, which would be the pre-diabetes population.
So that's what can be done about it. But in the short term, to what extent is this 30 million increase? What impact is that having on health services across India?
This increase definitely is going to impact health services. But the diagnosis of diabetes gives a kidney disease or eye disease 5 or 10 years from diagnosis. So again, it gives us a good opportunity to get people to control, to see that there is not a big burden on the system and healthcare system in the years to come. So overwhelming hospitals, I'm not totally worried about. What I am worried about is the conversion rates unless we start intervening. So I don't want more and more people with diabetes to be getting complications of diabetes, which take 5 to 10 years. This is not like COVID, where, you know, someone gets sick and, you know, the hospital system is overwhelmed and everything. It's not that at all. Diabetes is a slow progressive disease and gives us plenty of opportunities to do something about it. So I think it's more like an opportunity for every state government, people at the community, family, as well as the individual level, to start thinking about what they can do for themselves and for their families and communities. And I think that's where the focus should be.
That was Dr. Ranjit Anjana. One of Russia's most prominent human rights campaigners has gone on trial in Moscow for criticising the war in Ukraine. Oleg Orlov, who's 70, faces up to 3 years in jail for allegedly discrediting the Russian army. The BBC's Russia editor Steve Rosenberg attended the opening of the trial and reports now on the growing wave of repression in Russia.
From the moment he walked into the courtroom, it was clear what Oleg Orlov thought about his trial. He opened his briefcase, took out a book, and held it up to the TV cameras. The title, End of the Regime. It's worth a read. he declared. It's about how totalitarian and fascist regimes come to an end. Oleg Orlov is one of the most respected human rights campaigners in Russia. He faces up to 3 years in prison for his public criticism of Russia's war in Ukraine.
Называется она так. Публичные действия.
Ahead of the trial, Mr. Orlov told me more about the charges against him. He's accused of having repeatedly committed the following crime: discrediting the use of the Russian armed forces for protecting the interests of Russia and her citizens and preserving international peace and security.
То, что происходит в Украине, назовем это прямо война.
But what is happening in Ukraine, Oleg tells me, and let's be clear about this and call it a war, that is against the interests of Russia and Russian citizens. And as for preserving international peace and security, that's a joke.
Защиты международного мира и безопасности. Но, понимаете, это просто смешно.
What isn't a joke is the current wave of repression in Russia. The Kremlin is fighting two wars, one in Ukraine, the other at home, a war on dissent. It's put together a hefty toolbox of repressive laws to punish critics of the government and the war in Ukraine, like the law against spreading false information about the military. It's been used to imprison such prominent Putin opponents as Ilya Yashin, who was sentenced to 8.5 years in jail. As for the Kremlin critic Vladimir Karamurza, he was recently jailed for 25 years for treason.
По жестокости, по срокам.
By the level of cruelty and by the length of prison terms being handed out, this is reminiscent of Stalin's time, Oleg Orlov tells me. Civil society has been pushed underground, partially. I fear it may now be completely destroyed. But in Russia, those behind bars have not been forgotten. In a large room in the center of Moscow, people are sitting around tables, writing letters and postcards to political prisoners. Prisoners' portraits and biographies have been printed out on flyers and put on the tables, so you can choose who to write a message to. It's a monthly event organized by one of Russia's last remaining liberal parties. The room is packed. So what brings people here?
A guilt. A sense of guilt. People express their opinion, and for this opinion they go to jail. I want to support them.
I have some acquaintances which are already in prison, and I understand that these letters can save their lives, because Russian prison system is not lovely for them.
And as they continue to write, a cellist starts to play. The unsettling music seems to match the mood of apprehension, uncertainty, pessimism in Russia as repression grows. And yet, in a country where collective protest is restricted, putting pen to paper to help a political prisoner is a small act of defiance, and one way of showing that some people here won't be silenced.
Steve Rosenberg reporting there. Home Affairs ministers from the European Union have agreed to a plan to overhaul the bloc's migration and asylum policies. The proposals come as the number of people arriving to Europe in boats across the Mediterranean is up by 30% this year. Katia Adler has more.
EU Home Affairs ministers say they want to spread the rising number of asylum seekers, 80,000 in just the first 4 months of this year, more fairly, taking the strain off southern European countries such as Italy and Greece. Ministers also propose tougher internal border controls to prevent what's been dubbed asylum shopping, where migrants move north to wealthier EU countries, as well as a speedier method of processing and deporting those not thought eligible to claim asylum. Not all EU members, particularly Hungary and Poland, are on board with these proposals, which also need to be signed off by the European Parliament.
Katia Adler. Joseph Bologna, better known as Chevalier de Saint-Georges, lived one of the most extraordinary lives in modern history. Born in 1745 on a Caribbean slave plantation, by his musical brilliance, sheer charisma and tremendous luck, he made it to the upper echelons of the Parisian establishment of Marie Antoinette. And now his life has been turned into a film.
Welcome to Paris, Joseph.
Monsieur, I fear this will not be a kind place to such a boy.
Boy has talents, but one in particular that is exceptional.
Very well.
Stephen Williams directed the film that chronicled Joseph Bologna's colourful life.
Joseph Bologna led such an incredibly rich life. He was a classical composer, conductor, composer of opera, champion marksman, champion equestrian, man about town. He was a polyglot in every sense of the word. He was born in Guadeloupe and taken to Paris when he was about 10 years old and, you know, made his way into the upper echelons of French society before eventually kind of bearing arms against them in the Revolutionary War. I would say that Chevalier is only now coming into a greater sense of prominence that he has long been unjustly denied. He's been sidelined by history and forgotten. And weirdly, in many ways, he's kind of been hiding in plain sight. I felt a personal stake in telling Joseph Bologna's story and bringing it to the screen. I was born in Jamaica and I made my way to England, went to high school and university in England. And Joseph came from Guadeloupe and then was taken to Paris. And I was fascinated and compelled by the journey and the narrative beats of someone who finds themselves on the outside, on the margins of a dominant culture, and what the push and pulls of that experience are like. And I think that what can sometimes happen to people in that kind of situation, certainly happened to me, and I think it happened to Joseph, is that you come into this belief that through the exertion of ambition, you are going to impose yourself in a way on that culture that you find yourself on the periphery of. And through the exertion of that ambition, you hope that you're going to kind of put things to right, if you will. But it's never as straightforward as that may seem, and it's complicated. I wanted to immerse an audience in that sense of what would it have been like to have subjectively walked through Joseph's life with him, through his point of view. And so the music kind of occupied two kind of poles within that kind of pursuit. And one of them was obviously presenting as much of Joseph Bologna's music as we could get our hands on. One of the other tragic aspects of his story is that a lot of his music has been lost to the annals of time. And so we, you know, scrounged around and found as much of his music as we could. And we put it in the film in terms of the on-camera performances that our lead actor, Kelvin Harrison Jr., plays Chevalier, performs to kind of bridge that gap so that you didn't feel like you were watching a period piece through a time portal. It carries a sense of urgency and immediacy and a kind of current tonality to it.
That was the director, Stephen Williams. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Philip Bull and the producer was Beth Timmins. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
Satisfy your summer craving with Starbucks' new Chocolate Java Mint Frappuccino drink. Indulge in cool, chocolatey, minty goodness topped with layers of whipped cream. Get your sweet summer sidekick for a limited time with the Starbucks app today.